Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we meet Scott Stulen, the new executive director of Philbrook Museum of Art, who began his tenure this week. He replaces Rand Suffolk, who left the museum last fall to become the director of the High Museum of Art in Atlanta. Stulen comes to Philbrook from the Indianapolis Museum of Art, where he was the curator of audience experiences and performance, a position created for him. He previously worked at the Walker Art Center in Minneapolis and the Rochester Art Center in Rochester, Minnesota, where he was an associate curator and director of education there. His training is as a studio artist and sculptor. Stulen is known for creating programming that makes museums gathering places where people interact not only with the art, but with each other, sharing and intersecting with pop culture and immersive art environments. He's probably best known for creating the first Internet Cat Video Festival, which has since been shown at museums around the country. But he's quick to point out that programming like that are simply means to an end, to get people who would not normally come to a museum to walk into the museum, interact with its collections, and then find common interests and enthusiasms. He joins us today to share his visions for art museums in general and Philbrook in particular. Scott Stulen, welcome to Studio Tulsa and welcome to Tulsa.
Thanks for having me, and I'm glad to be here.
So what attracted you to the opening at Philbrook?
Well, to be honest, I wasn't looking for something right now, but when this position became available and was contacted about it, it had all the kind of components I was looking for in this type of position. So I've been kind of watching what Philbrook had been doing for the last several years, and it's really kind of forged a way of being an innovator in kind of being community engaged and really thinking about new ways of kind of welcoming audiences into the museum. And it also had a lot of these interesting components, having the garden, the villa, and then also this downtown space, which I think is really attractive. So all of those things together became a really attractive package. And then as I got to know more about Tulsa, it seemed like a city that was really on the rise as well. So it became a very hard to resist.
You mentioned the diversity of audiences coming to Philbrook. That's been a real focus of the museum over the last few years to really change the view of the audience that shows up, that it is open to the whole city. It's not just for a certain segment of the city, not for the culturally aware. It's right. Really for the whole city. How important is that to you?
It's very important. So I really feel that the arts should be for everybody. And to really have a welcoming space where everybody feels like not only Philbrook is for them, but they have content there that they understand, that's relevant to their daily lives, and they feel really energized and engaged by it, and sometimes challenged. But I want it to be like a community gathering place, a place that all sorts of audiences can come and mingle, connect, and for a lot of different things. Some days that might be to come and look at a painting on the wall. Another day might be coming to a film program. And maybe one day it's just to walk through the gardens. But you can kind of have it be your own institution. And I really enjoy it when those audiences cross over.
Now, how important is it to have that sort of a museum as a gathering space? You're starting to see this as a small C cultural institution where right. where a museum is catering to the high C, the capital C with artwork and art films and
right.
and installations, but also small C, which could be anything from low culture to pop culture to anything else in between.
Absolutely. Because I think you need to have a blend, and I think you can have a blend. And I don't think it actually diminishes from either side to have that. But in particular, if we're going to attract broader audiences and more people to come, I think you need to kind of delve into some maybe those more populist areas. And those are also the really good entry points. So there may be people that don't have an art degree like I do and that feel intimidated by the museum. And they're not sure where to come in. And nobody wants to feel stupid coming into an institution that they don't understand what they're seeing. So to find those ways where you can kind of soften some of that, have something. Maybe it's a film, maybe it's a family program coming in that you can be introduced. And I strongly feel the biggest hurdle is bringing somebody onto the grounds of the museum or into the campus. Once you're there, you're going to get exposed to all these other things that are happening. And we'll cross over into some of those, maybe the big C kind of area of things.
Now, a lot of times museums will do that with decorative arts or a little more populist programming where it's, everyday objects or found objects being turned into artworks.
Right.
But can you do that through other programming besides just exhibits?
Absolutely. And I think I've kind of built my career on kind of pushing that edge a little bit and really some things that people maybe don't expect to happen in a museum. And I love breaking kind of that perception that this is what happens there and this isn't. But I think as you're seeing, particularly with a younger audience, is they're really driven by event-driven programming. So things like films, things like music happening, performances, education programming, sometimes just discussions. And I think in general, creating it to be a social space, so a place that you want to come not just by yourself, but bring your friends, bring your family, and it feels comfortable for that. Some of that's just having amenities like a cafe, place to sit, place to have a drink after work, and then maybe go see a program that's happening there. But creating that vibe, so that kind of overall culture that's happening. And as far as some exhibitions can definitely do that, but it's also kind of challenging the notion of what's an exhibition too. So one of the projects, one of the last projects I did at the IMA in Indianapolis was we did an artist design mini golf course. So we invited artists to design these sculptures, but they're playable mini golf holes. But it was an exhibition, so they had didactics about them, and they all were riffing off of Indiana history. And so you got to play mini golf and go around and
oh, you
that.
Actually got to play.
Oh, you got to play.
So this was interactive.
Interactives. Right? And we had a bar out there too, so you had that component on top of it. But that show brought in a whole different audience that was coming, plus the core audience that was coming to the museum. And a lot of those people that were coming in, as they were waiting to play mini golf, were going into the galleries and seeing the other artwork too. And that's the big win, where you get that crossover.
Now, when you're doing an exhibit like that, you certainly have the space to do that at someplace like Philbrook.
Yes.
But you also have a very, in the actual villa, it's sort of geared towards, you know, 19th century French academic mm-hmm. art,
right.
You know, but what about the contemporary art that maybe more better sort of gives you a pathway from what you're seeing out on the mini golf course?
Sure. I think there's a lot of different avenues to get there. And I think, you know, it's looking at what does Philbrook have in the collection? What are some of the strengths? I mean, the villa is amazing. You have this opportunity of a really unique space, but how do we leverage that creatively? It isn't just one way that you have to kind of handle a historic house or that collection. And maybe it's working with the curators to have some of it's where you have contemporary work hung right next to some of the, you know, Renaissance work that's there too. So you think about how you tell that story differently and kind of change that and create different entry points for people. And I think contemporary work does that well because it feels very much about the time that we're living in now. And there's a lot of that type of work that can be highly interactive. So I'll just give you one example that I've already been looking at. There's an organ that's built into the villa, right?
Right.
And I have a lot of musician friends and people I've worked with and curated programs over the years that are already kind of like salivating at the thought of composing pieces for that organ in that place. And I think that's an interesting way of something that hasn't been like widely explored in the past that we could do that is something unique to Philbrook.
And is that something that the art museum should be doing? Because there are other institutions mm-hmm. that are commissioning composers to write music.
Correct.
What's the difference there?
Yeah, I think it is something the art museum should do. I think the art museum doesn't have to be limited to just visual art. It can really expand into other areas. And it's not to kind of compete with all the amazing other cultural institutions that are here in Tulsa and or other places in the country. But I think the unique thing about the art institution is its context. It is different putting a piece of music in a different context, like the villa. And it's also the opportunity that I think you can be more experimental and you can push that edge maybe a little bit more than you can, you know, maybe in a symphony hall where there's an expectation what happens there. I mean, they're also experimenting and trying to do some different things on that end of the world, of course. But I think there is something unique to that. And I think it's what I'm interested in is some of those artists that kind of straddle different genres in different areas. The musician that considers himself a visual artist and maybe do something that is... You know, I'd like to take those things that could be really a difficult type of music and how do you make it highly accessible? So I'll use one very brief example. We did a piece when I was in Indianapolis with an artist that there is basically a giant sundial. It's a contemporary art sculpture outside. And on the equinox, the rings line up. It's this kind of moment. So he gathered 75 guitar players from the community with electric guitars and amps. We plugged them all into a circle underneath it. And then when basically we chimed the clock at 5 o'clock with a very, very loud E chord of everybody in unison for a minute. And it became this kind of thing. But it was this community orchestra that we kind of assembled that was amazingly in tune. And we didn't pop any circuits. But it was a way of taking something that's very avant-garde in a way, but became this like almost like a community band.
And what was the reaction from the community? Was there a large crowd for this?
There was. People showed up hours ahead of time and set chairs up for this like event. I'm not sure they knew exactly what they were going to see either. But we had a good crowd. There was like, I think we ended up with like about 1,500 people there for this event. And the other kind of thing that was wonderful about it is that we engaged 75 musicians that are from the community, many of which had never stepped foot on the campus of the museum. And that was a big win there as well.
So, how important is it to get somebody to take that first step and go into a museum for the first time?
I think it's huge. And I think that's why I really feel strongly about education and family and programming for children as well as for adults. There's been many studies out there that the likelihood of you going to a museum as an adult is almost directly related to if you went as a child. If you didn't go at all as a kid, to cross that threshold later is very difficult. There's an intimidation there, or even it's just not on your radar. So I think that's important, and I also think to bring adults in and a wide array of audiences, that biggest thing is to make it feel welcoming. It's for you. It's about something you're interested in. It's not this dusty archive by any means. It's something that even if a work of art is 2,000 years old, that I can connect it to something that's in your daily life.
And it's a living, breathing piece of art.
Absolutely. Yeah. Meetings change, and how we look at things change over time, and that's what makes it exciting.
Yeah. My guest today is the new executive director of Philbrook Museum of Art, Scott Stulen, formerly the curator of audience experiences and performance at Indianapolis Museum of Art, and previous to that served at the Walker Art Center in Minneapolis. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, we've been talking about audience engagement and experiences. Yeah. This is a buzzword that's kind of going through museums these days. You know, the MoMAs and the Met, they may talk about it, but they really don't do a whole lot because there's just people who are going to come anyway.
Yeah, they
don't have to. The Art Institute of Chicago, for example. But for, say, a museum of Philbrook side or even a larger one like the Indianapolis, how important is this to securing their future?
I think it is the most important thing. I think for the future of, and I really think it does apply to all museums. I think it just isn't quite as pressing for, you know, the MoMAs of the world because they actually rely on this tourist audience that's coming in all the time. So they have
it's not even the resident.
It's not. I mean, they're of course coming, but they have this constant churn of people coming in that may be coming in once a year or once every 10 years, but they have that daily.
And that used to be an entree to art, going to one of these big museums. And now, with the price at $25, $27, $30, all of a sudden there's a whole segment of the market who may go to New York. They say, well, let's go see the Statue of Liberty instead of going to the Met or MoMA because it's so expensive.
And you may have seen there's a lot of financial troubles those museums have had recently, too, because they've expanded to a point where they're not able to support that from the audience that's coming. So even those really large institutions, it isn't working completely there. So I think, you know, particularly for smaller museums in the Midwest that aren't in those maybe like traditional art centers, you have to be able to look at how you're relevant in your community and look at home first. Because if you aren't like really, you know, engaged with that, your neighborhood, the community, what's happening there, you're going to have a really hard time surviving. And I think that's one of the things that's so attractive is that Philbrook's done that. And I'm hoping we can take that even to the next level going forward.
How do you measure audience engagement or, you know, audience experience? How do you go about measuring something like that?
It's hard. I mean, to really get, you get a lot of good anecdotal stories and things you can get with people. Getting that hard, you know, data from it is more difficult. I think some of it you gauge in what your membership numbers are and what kind of the response that you're getting there. I think you can get it from surveys, and I really am a strong believer in having good analytics on things, and that can be from surveys, that can be from doing things that are sent out to your membership. It can be just pulling people aside and having interviews in the museum, and some of it's observation. You know, one of the things I do frequently is actually just sitting in places, sit in a gallery, sit in the cafe and listen and see how people are responding to things. Are people lost? Can they not find their way around? Are people talking about something that didn't work out well or something that they're really raving about? But those can be really informative things. And I feel like your experience coming in, it doesn't start when you enter the gallery. It actually starts in the parking lot and the wayfinding to get to the museum. And it follows all the way through the gift shop, into the cafe, and the way that you leave. And that's your web presence. That's all of it. You want to have people be able to comfortably make it there, find their way around, have a good experience while they're there, and then want to come back. And a museum like Philbrook, there's more to do there than you could ever do in one day. And the hope is that we're generating an audience and a membership that's coming not once a year because they saw, you know, the Monet exhibit, they want to come and see, but they're coming once a month or maybe even more frequently than that because it's a cool place to hang out. You're not sure what you might happen. These things kind of pop up that are surprising. Or it's just a place that you want to be in and kind of, you know, relax, bring your friends and hang out.
Beyond that idea of being a place where you do hang out and sort of indulge the small C, how important is it as you come to Philbrook that you continue to build the collection and build the reason most people come to art museums
Absolutely.
When they think of coming to an art museum?
Correct. You can't ignore that. I mean, of course. And I'm.
And it's very difficult in these days.
It is. And it's, I think, the one thing, too, we need to, I think, there is be, you know, creative and innovative on that side, too. And, like, it, even if you're a MoMA, the amount of, like, major key works by the Picassos and the Monets that are available even on the market, if you had $200 million to spend, are almost non-existent, right?
Right.
And I'm not saying that would be even a wise investment at that point. There's so few artworks out there at that level that you can bring that's going to move the needle on the audience that's coming in. So I think you need to be smarter thinking about, you know, it's more on even on the contemporary side is who's the next? Who's our next Warhol? Who's our next artist here that we can maybe be one of the early advocates for? Can we bring in things that are really, you know, take a risk and bring in a younger artist that's doing something that's hungry and doing something really experimental? It's going to blow people away because they've never seen something like that before. I think the biggest thing about a museum as we go is to be in wonder of what we see in front of us. And that can be done a lot of different ways. And sometimes that can be done with work that's been in the collection for dozens of years. It's just looking at it in a new light. And how do we give that a new perspective? So I think it's to look at all those things. So both what we already have, but also what we can, you know, borrow from other institutions, what we can bring in. And I feel really fortunate to have four incredibly talented curators at the museum that are, you know, doing amazing work now. And I want to just support them to be able to kind of keep going in that direction. And hope I can find them the money to keep doing what they've been doing.
Well, you know, I can't let you leave without mentioning one of your probably most offbeat exhibitions, which was the first Internet Cat Video Festival. Yeah. Now, how did that come about?
Oh yeah, the cat video. I'll never, like, it'll follow me forever.
Yes,
I'm actually
it will.
Very proud of it. But and it's something that was a surprise. So this is one of those things where I worked on a project at the Walker called Open Field. So we literally had an open field next to the museum that was undeveloped, and we kind of noticed that the neighborhood was just using it as a space. So we kind of went with that. And so instead of trying to force some new behavior, we try to enhance the existing behavior in that space. So we put picnic tables out. We put a bar and grill there. We allowed people to borrow sporting goods from us and things like that. But it also created a platform that we could do a lot of experiments. So one of those is myself and an intern that was working with me at the time, Katie Hill. We thought it'd be interesting to take online content, so stuff from YouTube that you normally watch on your phone by yourself, and put it into a social environment where we'd watch it like you'd watch a traditional film. And we thought cat videos was the perfect subject.
And apparently the community did too. You had what, 10,000 people?
Yeah, 10,000 people showed up to the first event. We jammed the freeway up in two different directions. We would have had more people if they could have got there.
Wow.
It became this amazing phenomenon. We really thought 50 people were going to show up initially. And we had, so to give an idea of just kind of how it kind of blew up, when the Walker opened their new edition, I think they issued 6 media credentials for that. We had over 60 for the Cat Video Festival. And we were on the front page of the New York Times art section the next day after that. And it became this thing. And what I think was amazing about it is that why it worked is we did it sincerely, not as this ironic thing the museum was doing, not that tongue-in-cheek or with some sort of critical distance. We kind of embraced that we're going to do this thing, and the museum can be about something that's just joyful. And it can be a little frivolous, but it's more about, can this be a place of gathering? And what I say often about the Cat Video Festival is that it's not about cat videos. It's about watching cat videos together. It was that piece, right?
Right.
And then when I got back to my computer after the first festival, there was this whole list of people emailing that wanted to bring it to their institution. So it became a tour. and now it's in. It's broken off into its own nonprofit now that apart from the Walker, I still am on the advisory board and kind of help out with certain parts of it.
It took a life of its own.
It's been in 10 different countries now, I think over 250 different cities over the course of 4.5 years. And the big one that just got confirmed this week is it's going to be at the Sydney Opera House.
Now, when you take on programming like that, that was – I don't want to say it was a risk, because if maybe 100 people showed up, it would still would have been a nice event.
Right.
But when you do take risks like that, I mean, you run the risk of people saying, that sounds weird, I'm not going.
Yeah, and there was a big risk with that one. I mean, the truth is I kind of snuck that one through. And because I think there's always this perception from some particularly that are maybe more that traditional audience, and honestly, it's more inside the museum, I think, than even outside the museum. That, you know, we can't associate ourselves with that, or we can't dumb things down and have that kind of low culture intersect with our high culture there. But that's actually what was so interesting about it. And I think what came from it and what kind of proved that point to not be correct is that instead of having kind of this rejection, like, oh, no, the walker's not serious now, all these places are like, oh, no, this is really innovative in doing this. And we showed it at Bard College. It's just like the curator, like, central. So it was really embraced by a lot of those different areas in a very different way than I think that initial perception was going to be. Now, again, internally, there's always kind of some, like, tension about some of that. But I think the thing that was the most important is that we knew from that cat video festival, because we could track it, about 80 to 85% of those people had never stepped foot on the campus of the institution before. We also could track after it through all the links from the cat video stuff that those people were coming back, buying tickets for other events, bought memberships to things, because suddenly now that institution was relevant to them. Whereas before they just drove by it, like, that's just a building over there, that's not for me. Now they had this experience and they dug deeper and like, oh, well, that's kind of cool too. Maybe I'll check that out.
Now, give us a sense of how strong a link there was between people who had never been there before and people who would come back. Was it
20 to 30% that was coming.
That's amazing.
You know, for a culture institution, that's like a home run.
That's
right?
2,000 to 3,000 new people coming in and perhaps coming back to the institution, and maybe a fraction of those buying memberships.
Absolutely. And really that were on their radar now. And what was interesting is that when the festival toured to other museums, is seeing this happen other places too. So it wasn't just unique to the Walker, but it's seeing it other places. And then I took some of that same philosophy that kind of generated the Cat Video Festival is what I built the department that I built in Indianapolis on. And we did the Cat Video Festival there too, but we did this whole array of other programming, but based on the same kind of philosophy is how do we make things that are, you know, interactive, social, and experimental? That was kind of the focus of my division. And that was everything from doing, you know, creative film programming to bringing in and commissioning new musical works to just doing things with, we did a program right on the Saturday after Thanksgiving when everybody's out shopping called Silent Night. So when people are sick of their families and maybe sick of shopping, we had people come in and everything was silent. So it was silent tours, headphone concerts, silent films, meditation. We had massages in the galleries. But this idea of these things that were solitary and quiet in the space. So just being creative ways of approaching programming.
My guest today is Scott Stulen, the new executive director of Philbrook Museum of Art. He began work this past Monday, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. How are you learning about the museum? Are you going around and just watching people work, or what exactly?
What's creepily sneaking, you know, sneaking up behind them. A little bit of that. I think really the best way is, you know, I've got a lot of ideas coming in, but I think really what needs to happen, and I've done, you know, I've been doing a lot of research from afar and kind of meeting with people before we arrived here, but I think my first, you know, several months here, it's a lot of listening. So it's setting up meetings with my senior leadership team and like the whole staff at Philbrook and hearing what's working, what isn't working, what their aspirations are, kind of what direction we want to head with things. And we have a good framework, a good strategic plan, but it's really to understand the culture and the personalities. And I think of it as like this inventory. It's like, what are all the good assets that we have here? What's the collection? But what's that collection of people too? And then meeting with members and donors and the board and doing that same thing. And then expanding out to the community here. So I want to get out to meet, you know, many of the other leaders in town, and they have a wonderful transition team in place for me, so I'm going to be meeting, I feel like, everybody over the course of the next few months, which is good. And also we're getting out to see a lot of other, you know, attractions in town. So we've already been to a Drillers game and a Roughnecks game, and we'll be going to the Joshua Bell performance the symphony's doing coming up. And so I think I feel like really warmly welcomed by the city and having a lot of people helping.
So you're sort of taking a cultural inventory of this community as well as your facility.
Totally. And I think, you know, I don't want to come in with any assumptions from the outside, because there may be some things that, you know, I've done in the past or some ideas that'll work here, but maybe not. And what I don't want to do is come in and with something without really understanding what's already here. And I think it's to understand what's Philbrook's role in the community currently, where is there a void that maybe we can fill, and also, what are some things that other organizations are doing exceptionally well right now that we should just maybe can collaborate with or enhance or just point to in some ways?
Well, if I may ask, what are you seeing as the real strengths of the museum from this examination so far?
Sure. I think from thus far, I think there's a really talented, dedicated staff that's there. The board is highly engaged and can fundraise. I think that's a real strength. That's there. We, you know, always are going to need, you know, more to grow. I think the one thing is the institution definitely needs to grow in the coming years and find ways so we can find the support to do that. And I know a lot of people aren't completely aware that there isn't any public funding coming in into Philbrick. So it's we need to find ways to be able to support that. And I think for me, a big focus will be increasing our membership. You know, I want people that are enjoying the museum to feel invested and, you know, invest in it and helping us to continue to do these really exciting programs. It also has a really rich collection. And I think the assets of having that downtown space, which I think has just scratched the surface of the potential there, I'm really excited about having that kind of in our toolbox and figuring out some things about that. But then also having the gardens and the grounds with the villa and the collection there. And I want to create some more ways the gardens can kind of speak to the collection and back and forth. I think they're kind of separate entities right now, and have ways that we can have those be a little bit more kind of talking to one another. And, you know, I think I can say one dream I have is out there to have an outdoor classroom outside that has a kitchen so that we could do cooking classes outside in the garden and have things both for adults and kids that could happen out there.
Well, and you have this great campus, too, where you have formal gardens in a lot of the spots, but there are also just plots of land that are waiting for something.
Absolutely. And it's, I've got ideas. But but I think it's one of those really incredible assets. And also being right in the center of Midtown, too, that you have a neighborhood that's around the museum that can actually walk over and be part of it. But, I mean, one of the nice things about Tulsa that I've already kind of learned is that everything's really relatively close to get to, and that isn't every city. So I think that's a real asset, you know, there too. But yes, there's a lot of areas there that I think are just perfect for certain ideas, and maybe we will do a mini golf course.
Of course, you also mentioned attention too, because as a museum becomes more popular, then that neighborhood that it's in that is so nice feels put upon because of the popularity of the museum itself.
It is, and I think that'll be, you know, part of my role is to kind of smooth over some of those relationships. And I think it's, you know, one of those things, hopefully, is that you want to have a vibrant museum. It's partly why you live in some of those areas, is to have that asset, you know, there. But it's also be really mindful of, you know, having thousands of people coming to an event and, you know, the impact it has on the neighbors.
And it's probably a premature question, but where do you see Philbrick in about 5 years? What are some of the things you want to accomplish at this point? I mean, just sort of the big fuzzy goals.
I think the big picture of it is to really take the work that's, you know, my predecessors have kind of built the foundation here and take that to, you know, the next level. And I feel strongly as like we may never have the same collection as the Met here, but we can be the innovator, if not the best museum in the whole country, about how we engage our audience, are relevant to our community, create a warm and welcoming environment for people, and lead in both education and having this be a community social space. And all of those things are completely possible for Philbrick, and I think we're well down that path. And my goal is in 5 years, not only are we doing that, and we're building everything here, building our membership, building kind of our engagement to the community, but I want us to be recognized nationally for that. So I want everybody in the country to know what Philbrick's doing, and I think that they will. And I think that's something that we're going to strive for in the next 5 years.
Well, Scott Stulen, we wish you great success and welcome to Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Scott Stulen is the new executive director of Philbrick Museum of Art. You can learn more about the museum at philbrick.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.